Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA LP 107.3 FM Albany, broadcasting live from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Erica.
And I'm Helena. We will start off by talking about the upcoming 5th Annual Renewable Energy and Sustainable Living Fair hosted by Community Advocates for a Sustainable Environment, CASE.
Then we hear from David Gerard and Emily Quiro about the upcoming Troy Foundry Theater's Digital Gala.
Next, we have another weekly Triple E segment. This week from Denise Berkeley, Statewide Executive Vice President for CSEA.
After that, we hear from Dr. Emily Abua, Chemistry Professor and member of the Nature Labs Advisory Board, about the importance of community science centers.
Finally, we continue yesterday's conversation with Casey Camp Hornick to discuss environmental justice and why Congress must address pollution in the next stimulus bill. But first, some headlines.
New York Attorney General Letitia James on Tuesday sued Amazon, accusing the retail giant of disregarding worker safety during the coronavirus pandemic and retaliating against employees who raised concerns. The suit aims to force the company to take all affirmative steps, including changing policies, conducting training, and undergoing monitoring, among others, to ensure that Amazon reasonably and adequately protects the lives, health, and safety of its employees. It also seeks damages for unlawful retaliation against two workers who sounded alarms over safety conditions.
The Times Union reports that the State Assembly Republican Conference wants the legislature to form an impeachment position to gather facts and evidence in Governor Cuomo's handling of COVID-19 in nursing homes, including the administration's acknowledgement that it had deliberately delayed providing information to the legislature. The proposal is for a bipartisan panel consisting of 8 members, with 2 appointees from each legislative leader.
The Daily Gazette reports that Governor Cuomo has announced outdoor amusement parks can open this spring with a capacity limit of 33%. Overnight summer camps will also be allowed in 2021. As of Wednesday, the total COVID hospitalizations in the state were 6,574, down nearly 30% from the early January high. The statewide test positivity rate was 3.58% on Tuesday. The Capital Region's 7-day average test positivity rate has fallen to 2.1%.
Rensselaer County's residents who were scheduled to receive the second shot of the COVID-19 Moderna vaccine from the county this Thursday through Sunday have been told that it will now be postponed due to lack of vaccines.
A man serving 20 years in prison for his conviction on an attempted murder of a Troy High School basketball star in 2013 will receive a new trial after an appeals court ruled Thursday that he received an ineffective counsel at trial from one of the region's top defense lawyers.
The City of Albany's St. Patrick's Day Parade will go virtual in 2021 after being canceled last year.
The Labor Department reports that unemployment is on the rise nationally, with initial claims by unemployed workers rising by 13,000 last week to a seasonally adjusted 861,000. New York fared better, however, where the statewide number of initial claims fell by 2,436 to 57,547. State labor officials attributed the decline to fewer layoffs in the healthcare and social assistance, accommodation, food services, and retail trade industries.
President Joe Biden is proposing to extend 2 COVID-related unemployment programs through August as part of his $1.9 trillion relief package now before Congress. The legislation would also approve an additional $400 a week in federal jobless aid on top of state benefits.
For those just tuning in, you are listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about this program and how to support Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary.
For our first segment, Community Advocates for a Sustainable Environment, CASE, will hold their 5th annual Renewable Energy and Sustainable Living Fair virtually on Saturday, March 6th. The event will feature sustainable vendors, renewable energy, community groups, and speakers such as Rhea Salters of New York Renews. Bob Connors of CASE discusses the event with Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We're talking with Bob Connors, who is with the, among other things, Community Advocates for a Sustainable Environment. And they are sponsoring the 5th annual Renewable Energy and Sustainability Living Fair on March 6th. But due to the COVID crisis, this year is going to be a little different. So Bob, can you explain, you know, what is the Renewable Energy and Sustainable Fair and what's different about this year?
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me on your show again. Well, it will be Saturday, March 6th, as you mentioned, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And what's different is it will be virtual, as you mentioned, and that presents opportunities. And of course, in some respects, it may not be as appealing to people as the physical contact that they're used to. However, let's be positive. And so far, we've got nearly 30 exhibitors signed up. We expect to get a few more. And what will happen is, I'll try to outline it for you briefly. We will have what's called an exhibition hall where the exhibitors will be on display and they will be using Zoom. And we'll have a keynote speaker, Rhea Salter from Director of New York Renews. And we'll have workshops in various categories. And we'll have something called affinity groups where people can discuss particular topics. And you're going to have an opportunity to meet new people. And of course, the pluses are you don't worry about the weather, you don't worry about parking. It's a free event also.
So, you know, the exhibitors, you know, who are some of the exhibitors and, you know, how will you, you know, access them in a virtual setting?
Right. Well, people will, first of all, they have to register online to get their ticket. We call it free ticket, and exhibitors as well. They'll log in on a Zoom basis. And then it'll be obvious on the screen. We call the attendee can choose to go right into a particular exhibitor's hall, as it's called, or booth, as they might imagine it. Or they may choose to go listen to the speaker, the keynote speaker. They might choose to start doing some networking right away. Or they may choose to go into these affinity groups. So the attendee has lots of choices. And the exhibitors, there's so many, but perhaps it would be easier to mention categories. They will certainly be in the area. There'll be solar energy representatives, sustainability, zero waste exhibitors on discussing renewable heating, climate action, and many other categories as more exhibitors sign on. But that will give you a rough idea, I think.
So I think PAWS, which I'm involved with, People Evolving Out for Safe Energy, you know, that they've often been there. Maybe they focus more on zero waste. But say I go into a, you know, exhibitor, am I just going to go to a website or will it be a live person where I can, you know, ask questions? Are they going to make presentations? How's that going to work?
Right. They will be live. Once they use their Zoom, the customer or attendee will log in, have choices. Let's say they wanted to go visit the PAWS booth, as we call it. and there'll be representatives, single or plural, there from all the organizations, and they would click on the pause booth, and there it is. They'll be talking to Tina or Diana Wright, most likely, and then they can continue, you know, for 6 hours if they want, from 10 to 4. Most likely, the attendees will then finish with that particular exhibitor and move on to another booth, just as they would physically. You can visualize walking around, talking to exhibitors. It's very much the same, except it'll just be done digitally, if I can simplify it.
Right. Now you mentioned that the keynote speaker is Rhea Salter, who is the policy director of New York Renews, which is a broad coalition working on climate policies at the state level, particularly environmental justice. I know that Rhea is also one of the appointees to the state's Climate Action Council. But, you know, what's Rhea going to talk about during her keynote address?
Well, I think as you might know, she's the council itself is tasked with developing New York's climate action plan to get to net zero by 2050, which is required by the CLCPA, or let's call it the New York law. And that's going to be her focus, is, I believe, I can double check with her before March 6th, but I think she's going to discuss how we can get there to net zero by 2050. That's my understanding at this time.
Now, this is the fifth annual Renewable Energy and Sustainable Living Fair on Saturday, March 6th. How has the fair, evolved over its 5 years?
Wow, that's a good question, Mark. Our first year, I think we had about maybe 30 exhibitors. And last year, it was 2019, technically. We had 75 exhibitors at the Sage Armory in Albany. And we actually had to turn down exhibitors near the end. We were just too busy. So the popularity, if that's the word, is built up. We get a wide range of exhibitors, and we vet them as best we can. There's one or two we've decided not to reinvite over the years. And we find that the camaraderie is very important among the exhibitors and attendees. And we're going to try to recreate that again this year. I think it'll work because, number one, people are willing. And number two, it's an excellent way. It presents, I should mention, the exhibitors will have their information logged or saved on our webpage, Community Action Sustainable Environment, our webpage indefinitely. So exhibitors will and attendees will not only be able to find things out on March 6th, but they will also have the option of continuing to learn more on our webpage as time goes on. And I should mention, Mark, the exhibitors go on to our webpage. I'm going to abbreviate it and say CASE, our acronym, www.caseonline.org. And then the attendees will be able to sign up for a free ticket probably this week. So that's the footsteps for both the exhibitors and the attendees to follow. And the attendees can even provide a profile if they so chose. The attendees can also choose to have their information sent to all the various exhibitors if they so chose. So there'll be a lot of opportunities for the attendees and exhibitors to stay in touch with each other as time goes on. So that's a unique feature of having an online event this year.
So a little bit less than 2 minutes ago. So I'll ask you a two-part question. So, who should attend? You know, what's the average, Capital District resident going to get out of this? And then second, how do people pre-register for the event?
Right. To pre-register is right now the attendees, we call them, can go online right now. I say right now, it'll be later this week, and they will actually be able to register. We've done it as a test already amongst our members, so it works. And that will be, I should mention, it was developed by a great lady named Joan Elisa Seklik, who's from Eden Renewables.
Is there a URL for this?
Yeah, well, at the moment, it's simply URL is just www.caseonline.org is all anybody needs to do right now.
Okay.
And once they're on that page, they'll land there, and then they'll have the opportunity to register right now as an exhibitor, and in a few days to register as an attendee. Does that help you or answer your question?
And in the last 30 seconds, you know, why should Capital District residents show up at this?
Okay. Well, most of the exhibitors will be certainly within 100-mile radius of the Capital District, so they will be able to continue to learn more and perhaps do business from these various organizations. We're being very careful not to accept exhibitors from a long distance. We're trying to keep it within that 100-mile radius of the Capital District, Mark.
Okay. Well, we've been talking with Bob Connors of Community Advocates for Sustainable Environment, the Renewable Energy and Sustainable Living Fair, March 6th virtually. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Thank you, Mark, for reporting on Community Advocates for a Sustainable Environment. Thank you for joining us, Bob Connors.
For our next segment, HMM reporter Garrett McCary speaks with the Troy Foundry Theater's David Gerard, artistic director, and Emily Quirrell, producing executive director, about the upcoming digital gala performance and fundraiser.
Hello, I'm Garrett McCary, and with me today is members of the Troy Foundry Theater, the artistic director, David Gerard, and the producing executive director, Emily Quirrell. And we're going to be, talking about what you're calling a digital gala event. Thank you for not coming on Saturday, February 27th at 7 p.m. So why don't you tell us just a brief summary of what the organization does?
Well, we're kind of a group of like-minded artists, a lot of performers, but we're not necessarily all traditionally actors. We tend to have a smorgasbord of different disciplines kind of coming together. We are a very much a site-specific and immersive company. We work in and produce out of a lot of historic places in and around Troy. And we kind of conjure that kind of energy that is used to sort of meld something together out of the shapeless. That's sort of the idea of the foundry. We tend to work from a place that is very simple at the start, something thematically, and build work from the ground up using a lot of devising creating methodologies. We have a really strong company. We've got some new people in our ranks that we'll be sort of introducing in some ways through the digital gala, but also a lot of faces that folks have seen before.
We're also a not-for-profit, so that's a big part of our mission, along with our choice to participate in social justice work in the community, which is really embedded into the work that we choose to create as well.
And we tend to use sort of like this idea of taking something that is either extant writing or no writing at all, starting from the top, and again, just sort of building it from the ground up, a lot of times, again, using artists from various disciplines and sort of throwing it all together like a cauldron and mixing it up and seeing what happens.
And of course, 2020 was a difficult year for everyone, but you guys still managed to pull off a performance.
Yeah.
Yes, that was no small feat. And we were not sure if it was going to be able to happen. Obviously, we did this as safely as possible. We worked on a non-equity contract because, you know, the Actors Equity Union was not very freely allowing equity productions during this time. We performed outside in a parking lot so that people felt more safe to come and enjoy. And we really required our actors and our production team to be tested and quarantining as much as possible. So it was a massive organizational and artistic feat that we were able to accomplish. And the Trojan Alley series, which was live events outdoors in that same parking lot.
Yeah, it really gave us a chance to like introduce particularly new actors into our company who will be certainly working with more this year. but also introducing the Troy community or reintroducing the Troy community to a lot of musical artists. We did some silent film nights. We did some sort of community related events in the alley. So the alley ended up presenting itself as a new venue out of nowhere, which is sort of typical to our work of using a non-traditional space. But given the pandemic and the limits of being able to produce inside, to have that space readily available to us really ended up being a gift during 2020, during a difficult year.
And that parking lot is owned by E. Stewart Jones Hacker Murphy Law Firm, and they graciously donated the space to us to use as we needed.
Yeah, we love Stu and Kim.
I'm speaking with David Girard and Emily Curo from the Troy Foundry Theater. So let's talk about your event, Thank You For Not Coming. Can you tell me something about it? It sounds like an exciting thing.
It's massive. It's become more massive as we as we've planned. I don't want to give all our surprises away, but I will talk about the things that we've announced. So essentially, we knew that we wanted to do a fundraising event to kind of bring us into 2021. We have a lot of great supporters out there, but we also knew that it couldn't be in person. So we decided that we were going to do a live stream performance, which will end up being a combination of pre-recorded and live content set in the world of a telethon in some sort of time period between 1950 and 1980.
This whole event is actually a performance as well.
It is
couched in this idea of that typical sort of like, you know, host with the phone bank behind him, you know, getting people to call in. It will be a live event. So in some ways it'll feel maybe a little bit like SNL, that we'll be going from live portions to pre-recorded portions. We also have some really great live performers. We have Connor Armbruster, who's an incredible violinist, is going to be doing a piece. We have Zan from Zan and the Winter Folk also playing a number. And finally, we have The Age. Adrian actually was one of our biggest events in our Alley series, in our Trojan Alley series. He really brought a big crowd with him. So it's really nice to kind of welcome him back to close out the piece. We also have a lot of surprises throughout the program. We will be announcing our two main stage productions and teasing those, as well as some possible celebrity callers. And we do have a great host. We're super, super excited. Can I announce the host? Can we talk about the host?
Sure.
So we have Mikey Gregg from Zan and the Winter Folk. He's their banjo player hosting for us. And Mikey, if anybody knows Mikey Gregg, he is an incredibly charming and hilarious individual. He used to host a lot of open mic events throughout the area, and particularly at Little Pex. And we are just absolutely thrilled to have him. He did actually an open mic for us this summer during the Trojan Alley series. We knew we wanted to work with him again. We've worked with Zan and the Winter Folk several times. So to have Mikey come in and embody this character of the host for this program, we're super excited about.
I was going to ask about the live auction. Because you have some very interesting things here. We're running out of time already, but
oh my goodness, I can talk fast
about that, because the first one I was seeing here, you have this for $2,500 suggested value, the mini mobile. Basically, what you're doing is you're giving your troupe.
Like everything we do, our silent auction is going to be a little bit different, a little bit stranger, a little bit more curious. So in order to bid on the live auction, that's happening actually during the event. So you have to buy a ticket. We have different ticket prices, so you can buy at any level to support us. We have starting at $50 tickets, going all the way up to $500. It gets you the same access. When we start that live auction, people will be bidding in live time over the Zoom link. So that's going to be really exciting. Our highest bid or our highest auction item is, in fact, the TFT Mini Mobile Series, where we will essentially create a performance for you and bring it to you, wherever that may be, your home, your backyard, the park across the street. The next
can I submit a script for you to perform, or is this something that modified?
It will be a devised piece, so we won't be starting with a script, but that doesn't mean that you couldn't say, I've always wanted to see a piece of work about car tires, and maybe maybe we could make something. I know we could make something really cool.
This could be a great event for some organization that is having some kind of fundraiser and needs some something to bring it together. You know,
totally. Or it could just be a group of six friends that
yep
are very interested in our process and our creation and want to hold a private event.
Yeah, my hope is somebody that bids on it has a beautiful cabin up in the Adirondacks on a lake. That would be really
yeah
wonderful.
And
or an island retreat maybe, somewhere, right?
Yes,
an island retreat. Yes.
Quickly, the last three auction items. The next level is a summer salon. So that's something that we have done before. It's kind of a smaller version of the mobile series. It's not a full performance, but perhaps a backyard evening with 15 of your friends with some live music, some performance pieces curated by us. Then we have the Cooking with Botwick package where Ethan, depending on your COVID level of safety, he can come to your home, cook in your kitchen and serve you food, or he'll cook it at his home and deliver it to you. And there's not a lot of restrictions on that one. And then the final one is some private dance lessons provided by Jennifer Volpe of Jennifer Volpe Dance Company, who we've also worked with.
This event is the Thank You for Not Coming Digital Gala. And how do people contact you?
You can buy tickets by visiting our website, www.troyfoundrytheater.com. You can just click right on the gala image on the top and it will take you to the info page and the ticket page. You can also find it on our Facebook and on our Instagram. You don't have to live bid on the auction. You can just buy a ticket and attend and watch the show. That's great too.
That's great. All right. Well, David and Emily, it's always been fun to talk to you guys, and I'll hear you sometime on Saturday, February 27th at 7 p.m. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Garrett.
The Troy Foundry Theater's Digital Gala will be happening on Saturday, February 27th at 7 p.m. It will feature music, performance, and live auction. For tickets, go to troyfoundrytheater.com. A splendid time is guaranteed for all.
For those just tuning in, I'm Erica.
And I'm Helena. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Triple E's host, H. Boss Jr., speaks with Denise Berkeley, Statewide Executive Vice President for Civil Service Employees Association, CSEA. Berkeley is also the chair of American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Racial, Social, and Economic Justice Work Group, where she leads union members across the country in addressing racism and injustice, both in the labor movement and in the larger national conversation.
Hello again, everyone. This is H. Bosch Jr. with another Triple E segment, Education, Empowerment, Entrepreneurship. Today's guest, the Honorable Denise Berkeley, Executive Vice President of the New York CSEA Union. How you doing? How you doing?
I am doing well. Thank God. It's a beautiful day. The sun is out. Doing well.
Let me start with, since New York State has been hiring contract and temporary staff, how can CSEA remain strong with these hiring practices?
And you know, we've always been against contracting out. That has been an issue with CSEA forever. So we fight management on that issue of contracting out our jobs to some type of outside agency. And as for dealing with temporary workers, we try to, once they come into any CSEA workspace, we try to make sure we bring them in to become a union member immediately. That is very important.
With COVID-19, what's in place to protect essential workers employed around the state?
Well, we have an excellent health and safety department within CSEA, and we have specialists that cover throughout the state from the Canadian border to New York City. And we give a lot of education, a lot of information about make sure you have your PVDs, making sure management is complying and supplying, and making sure that you have all the information to deal with COVID, vaccinations, and all of that. So we are really on top of this situation.
What efforts are being made to hire more minorities and provide an equitable system of advancement?
As we speak, we're doing that now. CSEA has two components. One, we have a personnel committee that consists of membership leaders from the board of directors and staff, and they are part of the hiring practice in reference to hiring staff. And on that personnel committee, we have people of color to make sure that we are hiring people of color for various positions within CSEA. Another check and balance, we have a human rights committee that consists of multiracial people of color to make sure we stay accountable in terms of hiring within CSEA and advancement. So we are on top of that on two levels, on the hiring level, and to make sure that we are following all the EEOCs and everything we have to follow to have people of color within CSEA.
So post-presidential election, what is the union doing to recruit young people and minorities to run for political office and be encouraged or engaged in their communities?
We are pushing a lot to do some more internship with our political action department. You can't, if you don't see it, how can I run for it? How can I do it? So we're doing more education in that area and make sure we're getting young minorities to grow and students and legal students to come into the legal department to do a lot of internship, political action, and the legal department in that area. Great. We want to improve really in that area. Absolutely.
So now that we have a new president and a new political environment, how do you think this will affect the union going forward?
We are happy. Biden and Harris are pro-union. So we are happy. We were out there advocating, making sure they get elected. We are happy. And we're hoping that they will pass the PRO Act, which is an act protecting the right to organize. We want every work location that workers have a right to organize and get into the labor movement. I can't say it any further. The Black middle class came about because of the labor unions, and we need Black people in labor unions, all job segments, every area in the labor movement.
How difficult was your journey from being a local union representative to your current position, Executive Vice President of CSEA, AFME Local 1000.
And we called the Civil Service Employees Association. It was not always easy. It was not always easy. I started in 79 as a shop steward. In 1981, I was elected local president of Brooklyn Developmental Center in East Brooklyn. I am proud to say I am 66 years old. I am so grateful for it. And it wasn't always easy being a young Black woman. And always, I had to always fight this one issue, how to have my voice heard, that you don't negate me. You don't say because you're not important. Remember two things. I started as a young Black woman, a leader in a developmental center. We are all direct care workers. We work with the disabled. And also, so sometimes we were marginalized in that area. And I was also marginalized as being a Black woman leader, that my voice couldn't be heard, or you cannot be speak up on an issue. Do you really know about this issue? Are you knowledgeable? I always had to put that to rest. When I teach my other leaders in the room, my other officers, when you walk in a room, you're on the same level as everybody else in that room. You claim your space, you claim your voice, you don't back down, you come in with your facts, and they have to deal with you. So that was something that I had to deal with. And one part also happened with me. In the 90s, I was suspended for 5 years.
Wow.
And to be honest with you, Ambash, it was a blessing for me.
Okay.
I say this reason. I love union work. I've always have, from 1979 up until today. But the union became like an idol to me. I had everything was union, union, union. And I was suspended because I was outspoken. Remember, a lot of times they don't want you to be outspoken. They don't want you to be addressing what's going on. But Bosch, I was able to be suspended. I got closer. For me, it was spiritual. I got closer to God. And I came back. I was reelected again. After 5 years being suspended, the membership put me back in, and the rest is history. president to statewide secretary to now executive statewide executive vice president.
Would it be safe to say, Madam President, you turned a setback into a setup for a comeback?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Good. And I praise God for it. Absolutely. Good.
So yes. Let's discuss how you have, and I love this part about you. Let's discuss how you have mentored and empowered other women of color in the union profession. Example, helping them improve their unions, run for leadership positions within their unions, and run for political office in their communities.
I've always believed that's one of the most important roles that I would have. I believe in servant leadership, and I believe in mentoring young women, women of color, Black women, to run for office. Either run for a local unit office, to run for a local office, to run for region office, run for statewide, and even to run for political offices outside. Letting you believe in who you are, that you have the skills, you have the capabilities, it is durable, you can do it. No one can stop you, and make sure that you are reaching back and bringing somebody else with you. And I believe in that. And I've been out throughout since 79 up until today.
Wow, that is great. Absolutely awesome. So let's discuss your activism against apartheid in South Africa in your youth, which was only 10 or 20 years ago, right?
Actually, I started even a little bit before that.
Okay.
You see the movie Black Messiah is out now?
Yes, 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 about the Black Panther movement.
About the Black Panther. I started with one of my first, I was 14 years old, my God. And I started with, I lived in Harlem. And they had a free breakfast program. And I was involved with that part of the Panthers. So when I saw the movie, I was like, oh, wow, I remember I was doing that. And how enlightening that was in terms of feeding our community. And so I started with that. And then also, I'm going real back now. I'm really dating myself. I was involved with the anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, helping how to organize that, how to protect yourself if you were in a rally, how to keep yourself safe. I was involved with that. And so all of this union activism, community activism, led me into the anti-apartheid movement, that we are connected nationally, internationally. All of the issues that we're dealing with here in America, they were dealing with that in South Africa. And we had to be connected with that same struggle, that same fight. It did our members to see the correlation that is all connected. Mm. And it's all in struggle there, struggle here. It's all connected.
This was part one of a two-part segment with Denise Berkley, Executive Vice President, CSEA Union. This is Inez Bosch's baby boy and your overcoming adversity specialist, H. Bosch Jr., doing what I'm made to believe.
That was part one of a two-part interview with Denise Berkley. Tune in next week to hear the rest of this Triple E segment by H. Bosch Jr.
Now for another episode from the ongoing series called Scientific Knowledge is Power. Scientific literacy fostered by community science centers can be an effective means for self-advocacy for communities that otherwise would have great difficulty making their voices heard in discussions of health and environmental issues. In this episode, McKenna Connors discusses these topics with Dr. Emily Oboya, who is a chemistry professor and a member of the Nature Labs Advocacy Board.
So how are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. And how are you?
I'm doing awesome. So what are your thoughts on experiential learning and how it can improve scientific literacy?
Okay. So experiential learning to me pretty much just means learning through experience. And because I'm a science teacher, I'm a science educator, I really value experiential learning because it helps students be able to really visualize or understand what they're learning when they have to experience it firsthand. And so I find that a very important component of learning, because it helps students understand the science and also understand how the science applies in their day-to-day life.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's super cool. So what do you, like, how do you think community science centers can benefit the community?
Community science centers are very important in to our community because, first of all, they're accessible. When we think about our community, it's very diverse. It's composed of different people from different walks of life. Some of them are people who have attended college or people who have access to college. Some of them don't. Some of them have access to formal schooling, and some of them probably don't. And so I see community centers as a place that is more accessible and has more direct contact with the community that we are serving. And so they can benefit the community in terms of having programs or curricula or activities that can engage community members in a way that they would otherwise not be engaged in a school setup.
Yeah, that, like, accessibility in science is just great, and it's so important for, you know, mm-hmm. helping people understand more about how they can, you know, be benefited by science. So,
yes, I agree.
What are your thoughts on the relationship between scientific literacy and self-advocacy in regards to health and environmental safety and well-being?
This is actually a very passionate topic for me. And this is because you find that in some communities that are underserved or disadvantaged, you find that they go through some challenges with regards to health and environmental safety. And the reason why some of these communities do not receive any type of help is because most of the people who are supposed to be, the community is not scientifically literate. They don't understand what the problems are. And even if they see that there is a problem, they really don't know the avenues that they would take to solve that problem. Case in point is the problem with lead in drinking water. You find that sometimes in some communities, they don't actually know that their water is infected with lead, and they might know that it is, but they would not be able to know how to communicate that or how to advocate for themselves to get their water cleaned up or to get that taken care of. And so I see, first of all, it's important that we find ways to educate our community to know what the levels of health should be, or to know what how a healthy, thriving community should look like in terms of the environment. Once they know that, then we also need to be able to help them figure out how to advocate for themselves. So in case there's a problem in the community, where do I go? Do I go to my area mayor? Do I go to where? And even if you know where to go, what methods should you use to advocate for yourself? Should you be writing letters? Should you be, you know, out there in the street protesting? Should you be, you know, going to your local authorities to, like, demand certain things? So I see this as very important, first of all, just be able to educate the community in terms of what should be happening, and also not just leaving it there, also helping them to learn where to go for advocacy and how to advocate for themselves.
Yeah, definitely. So what sort of suggestions would you have for those who are seeking to create community science centers and labs designed for public use?
This is also a very other, it's still related to what we just talked about. Yeah. For me, the type of what suggestion I would give is to have strategy. Strategy is very important, because if we don't have strategic thinking, and if we don't have a plan on how we want to tackle these issues, there will be no, you know, we will not have any valuable work done. a lot of times I see people are very passionate about community science and wanting to have some programs designed for the community, but oftentimes there's no strategy in how to do it. So it often leads to no concrete results. So we need to have a proper strategy in terms of what programs are being offered, and these programs, what grade level are they being offered at? And can we find a way to make sure that the curriculum that we are offering at this community center matches up with the curriculum that is desired or required from the school setup, so that when teachers are sending students to these community science centers, they will be seeing value in what's happening. It's not just a matter of students coming in to participate in an activity, but there's some real learning going on. So we need to have some strategies so that we ensure that there's some real learning happening to the students, and also to ensure that there's an overall goal that we are looking to achieve for the community and for the students as well.
Yeah, awesome. So what led to you becoming involved with the Nature Lab, and what do you hope it can achieve?
Exactly what I just talked to you, strategy. So yeah. I've been working with the Nature Lab for a period of time now, and I saw the Nature Lab as a place that has real potential. Nature Lab is great in terms of it offers this space that is very versatile and attractive to people from to students and pretty much just anyone who has a passion for the community, has a passion for science. That is like a space. It's like a fertile ground to grow these objectives that people have. And so I saw a lot of good stuff going on. We had students from the middle school coming in. We had students from RPI coming in. I had my students from SAGE coming in there, and students were doing different things. There are people who are passionate about science. They could do their science projects. There are people who are passionate about radio. They could do their radio podcasts. There are people who are passionate about just health. They could do their health stuff in there. So the ground is fertile ground. And I think there's a lot of potential for good stuff to happen. So I saw my role in this involvement with Nature Lab as just coming in as someone who's a science professional, designing these programs that I think would be beneficial for the students, and also having a real strategy in how this will lead to learning and how this would also lead to benefiting the community.
That was McKenna Connors talking with Dr. Emily Abuya, a chemistry professor and a member of the Nature Labs Advisory Board.
We end tonight with the continuation of a conversation we began yesterday with Casey Kampornik of the Punkwa Tribe. 57 organizations signed a letter to Congress with recommendations to address plastic pollution and environmental justice in petrochemical corridors. HMM's Alexis Goldsmith spoke to Casey Kampornik to discuss environmental justice and why Congress must address pollution in the next stimulus bill.
We're speaking with Casey Kampornik, matriarch and environmental ambassador of the Ponca tribe in Oklahoma. Casey, earlier in our conversation, you mentioned that your mode of environmental advocacy changed in the 1980s. Could you talk more about what you meant by that?
Yeah, I suppose awareness grew. When one becomes inured to the business of fossil fuels, as we all have been, by watching the commercials, by driving our cars, by flying, by whatever means, by how they tricked us into thinking this was okay and a norm. We of the Ponca Nation had such a survival story, being part of the forest removal where 1 in 3 die, being impacted by smallpox blankets, being given, quote, unquote, to us in the first form of that kind of warfare way back in the 1700s. Our tribe's been reduced to 200 before. We grow back, and then something else happens. That's federal government, who, by the way, made 5 treaties with us and also has broken every one of those. And that deals with our health, that deals with our well-being. And so when we got into the 60s and 70s and began to assert civil rights in the forms of what is now called activism, and to begin to reclaim our language, which was stripped from us, our culture, which was stripped from us, our economic development. We also noticed in this, again, 60s and 70s, many things were going on. And then we get to the 1980s, and we noticed that the Department of Energy, through the federal government, of course, is targeting Native nations all across the United States and saying, look, we'll help you develop economically. All you have to do is take this nuclear waste. Won't hurt you a bit. You just bury it in the ground over there. It's okay. You ignore it. You get some money for that. Oh, look, we've got this wonderful plant called Waste Tech that's going to bring hazardous waste from Chicago and Philadelphia and various other places. And you can put it far away from where your tribal headquarters is. Not going to bother you a bit. Perfectly safe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So our civil rights attention was then turned towards, oh my goodness, here's another genocidal process that they're trying to shove money at us. And knowing that we live with like 60 to 80% unemployment, it looks good. It looks like something that can help us. So we have to educate ourselves and our people about what does this mean in reality and see exactly where the pitfalls are and see the long-term results, because we're taught to look down the road 7 generations to prepare for them. So here we are. So then the attention is shifted to that. Then the awareness hits us. Oh my goodness. No wonder we have cancers in every family. No wonder our asthma rates are through the roof. No wonder we have autoimmune diseases. It's ConocoPhillips. It is Continental Carbon Black. It is the coal fire generating plant. It is the landfill that's seeping. Now it's fracking. Now it's injection wells. Now it's pipelines leaking. So that's what brought me here today.
A minute ago, you mentioned that humans are facing an existential crisis that many creatures are included in, are hanging by a thread. Those weren't your words, but paraphrasing. How can we look ahead 7 generations now to prevent that from happening?
First, everyone should understand that there is no choice. Either we get in line and align human law with natural law, or we will go the way of all of the species that we have caused the extinction of. Humans are not separate, above, below anything that is part of the great mysteries creation. We were set in place in a manner that would allow us to be part of a system of life that was interdependent with all that is. That, you know, if one sat home and during this COVID crisis, which again, humans can take credit for because of our, well, we don't need to keep going that way. But if we look outside our windows and we watch the birds are still behaving in the manner in which the Creator put them here. to the extent that they're capable. I can look out my windows and see other animals. And I live in the country, and I have that honor. So everything is living in the manner it was intended to, except humans. And for that reason, because we have things so out of balance, our very future is in danger as a species. What can we do? We can realign ourselves. We can, you know, they're talking about rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement and acting as if that's going to be the panacea. But in reality, there is so much more that has to be done than that. We have to recognize the catchphrases that are happening out there. Carbon trading, for instance, commodification of the air, the water, the earth, the plants that are being, I'm talking about the corn and others that are being bioengineered. Those kind of things have to be addressed immediately. We can't continue to think that it's okay for us to rearrange life around our own comfort zone and for life to accommodate that unless we take care of it. There has to be spaces for the four legs to run and feed and breathe and drink. There has to be spaces for the winged ones, the finned ones, those that live under the ground. There has to be a stop to the commodification of the very sacred water herself and the plastics that are created to put her in. There has to be a stop to the commodification of the air. That's what carbon trading is. There has to be a stop to the commodification of the very seeds that feed us. Yeah. It's up to us to educate ourselves and to do what is necessary to make that happen immediately.
That was HMM correspondent Alexis Goldsmith speaking to Casey Camp Hornick of the Ponoc tribe. This is the second part of a three-part interview. Tune back in tomorrow to hear the final segment and find the entire interview on our website.
And that concludes our show. And wow, it went out with a bang. What did you think about the show, Erica?
I thought it was very riveting, and I loved every piece of content that our wonderful content makers provided with us. Well, that concludes our show, folks. I really hope you've enjoyed listening to our segments, and I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine as much as I did. I'm Erica.
And I'm Helena. Our engineer is Sina. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through Hudson Valley Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or to comment on our work, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you are interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email info@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meeting on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. by sending an email requesting an invitation link to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thank you so much for tuning in to the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.